Chapter 10 Difficult Issues. Organ donation, suicide, euthanasia, miscarriage, and abortion are complex and challenging topics. They involve spirituality, psychology, politics, ethics, religion, gender, sexuality, economics, culture, and a host of intellectual and emotional responses that are highly charged. Because the subsequent emotional, medical, legal, and karmic implications are profound, we need to think deeply before we act. It is beyond our reach to thoroughly explore these topics. The challenge here is to offer sane advice in one brief section. It's always best to consult with our spiritual teacher or a lama well-versed in these areas. It also helps to remember that the sometimes strong words from the Buddhist tradition about these matters usually don't come from judgmental people or those out of touch with the times. At its best, this is advice from compassionate masters who act as representatives of reality. Their sole purpose is to relieve our suffering, now and in the future. Their counsel is based on a profound understanding of the laws of reality, in particular the immutable laws of karma, and the purest motivation to benefit others. We may not always resonate with that advice. It's easy to convince ourselves that their words are too traditional or disconnected from modern life. It's like gravity. We may not like gravity and the way it constricts our life, and we may not like the laws of karma and the implications of our actions. But karma is as impersonal as gravity. In the end, we have no choice but to abide by the laws of reality. The more we know about them, the more skillful our actions become. Spiritual masters can point them out. Buddhist scholar Judith Simmer Brown says, "The most important thing is for practitioners to study the tradition carefully, especially the Abhidharma, Madhyamaka, and Yoga Achara Buddha nature. To know karma well, both in the relative and absolute perspective, to respect and turn to the lamas for advice and consider it, and to engage creatively with the tradition, making sure to understand one's own personal motivation. We are active participants here, not passive recipients of the tradition." Some spiritual masters may not fully comprehend our quirks and idiosyncrasies, our cultural and therefore superficial expressions. But they often understand the nature of mind and reality from which those superficial expressions arise. They get the heart of the matter. This itself is a charged topic. I'm not saying that spiritual masters are always the final word, but I am empowering their advice and the motivation that gives rise to it. We are the final word. Our own wisdom, compassion, and motivation is where we take final refuge and responsibility for our actions. Author Scott Edelstein says, "Part of our job as students is to give our teachers the right amount of power. This means allowing them to influence us, perhaps quite deeply, but not allowing them to brainwash us, control us, or make us smaller or less human. In practice, this means subjecting everything a teacher says to our own careful scrutiny. As you attend to a teacher's words and actions, do they seem right to your heart, your gut, and your head, or do they feel off the mark? Do they emphasize that the teacher is every bit as human as you, or do they imply that the teacher is more or better than human? Does the teacher consistently serve your and other students' best interests, or do they appear to serve or gratify themselves? Scrutiny isn't an insult to any teacher. On the contrary, it's a way to take them and yourself seriously. The more insightful a teacher is, the more your scrutiny will validate what they say, and the deeper their teaching will sink in." While the teachings of the four main schools of Tibetan Buddhism are in general agreement about the central aspects of death, dying, and rebirth, there are differences. Teachers themselves may not always be consistent. A master may offer advice to one person that doesn't even agree with what that master said to another person. The emotional and spiritual complexities around the difficult issues surrounding death and the differing contexts in which they arise invite disparate interpretations. Advice around these matters is very individual. Reality especially around death, is not tidy. Consult others and contemplate fully before karma is irrevocably set by your actions. The following sections point out some of the principal issues and offer the most general guidelines. They are not meant to be definitive, merely suggestive. Organ donation. Organ donation is a common issue for Buddhists. This is because of tukdham, the meditative absorption that we discussed in Part 1. It is traditionally taught that the body should not be disturbed for 3 days after death, so that tukdham can be honored and preserved. But other teachings say that donating our organs, which must be harvested immediately after death, is the final gesture of a bodhisattva to benefit others. What should we do? As with any difficult issue, it is good to ask your teacher. Most of the lamas I consulted echoed these words of Kenpo Sultrim Gyamso Rinpoche. Organ donation is good. It is totally in harmony with the Mahayana practice of giving away parts of your body for the benefit of others, which the Buddha himself did many times as a bodhisattva. Some people say that it is not good to give organs if you are a Vajrayana practitioner, because it is not good to imagine the Yadam deity as being dissected. However, you should simply dissolve your visualization of yourself as the Yadam deity before giving away your organs. If you do it that way, giving away organs is not in any way contradictory with Vajrayana practice. Most beginning practitioners will not enter tukdham, so disrupting it is not an issue. For advanced meditators who may be in tukdham, their practice is probably stable enough that it doesn't matter what happens to the body. Gross levels of mind are connected to the gross physical body. Subtle levels of mind are not. Kenpo Rinpoche's advice applies to practitioners somewhere in between. Dr. Mitchell Levy, physician to Trungpa Rinpoche, says, Trungpa Rinpoche said that if during your lifetime you decide to donate your organs, and you make that decision while you are alive and able to think about it, then that is an act of generosity. A general guideline, in life as in death, is that if you're in doubt about what to do, don't think about yourself. Think about the benefit of others. When you're just not sure what to do, open your heart, love, and give. By doing so, your actions will benefit others, and your motivation will benefit you. 18 people a day die in the United States while awaiting organ transplants. Over 108,000 people in America alone are waiting for heart, kidney, liver, lung, and pancreas transplants. Tens of thousands are in need of corneas, bone and other tissues, and skin to heal burns. Each person who donates has the potential of saving or enhancing more than 50 lives. You also take up to 8 people off the waiting list. If organs are to be donated, keep the body undisturbed for as long as possible without compromising the medical end of things. If it's necessary to harvest an organ right away, then do it. Surgeons usually wait 2 to 5 minutes to make sure the person is dead before beginning to harvest any organs. Just before the organs are harvested, pull the hair or tap forcefully at the side of the Brahmarandhra. The Brahmarandhra is sometimes called the 10th gate. It lies about 8 finger widths back from a normal hairline and is considered the most auspicious gate for consciousness to leave at death. Place the poa powder or pill there if you have it. If consciousness hasn't left the body yet, this can facilitate the transference. According to the Dalai Lama, sand from the Kala Chakra Mandala mixed with butter can also be placed on the Brahmarandhra. Lama Zopa Rinpoche says that burning incense will help end the tukdham. Euthanasia. Euthanasia is another challenging topic. Is it okay to pull the plug? The first issue is our motivation. If we're the one helping to euthanize a sentient being, why are we doing it? Are we doing it to remove their suffering or to remove our anxiety around witnessing that suffering? Who are we trying to benefit, and why do we think it brings benefit? These kinds of questions help to reveal hidden motivations that can guide us through this complex issue. It's also imperative to realize that people rarely ask for euthanasia when their needs are met. If someone is feeling loved and valued and has their physical symptoms managed, they generally won't ask to be euthanized. There is a difference between active and passive euthanasia. Active euthanasia is actively ending a life, and the tradition is clear on this. Don't do it. Even though the motivation may be to end suffering, and that does soften the karmic consequences, refer to the four aspects of a fully constituted karma discussed previously. Active euthanasia still has significant karmic repercussions. Active euthanasia, however well-intentioned, is based on two fundamental misconceptions. The first is that experience ends with death. Although the purpose of euthanasia is to end suffering, not all suffering ends with death. Because we mistakenly identify mind with brain, we assume the mind dies when the brain dies. But mind continues. As religious scholar Houston Smith put it, "The brain breathes the mind, the way lungs breathe the air." As we have seen, when the body drops away at death, mind becomes reality. If the mind of the dying person was filled with suffering, that experience can initially be amplified. The physical pain from a diseased body disappears, but the suffering within the mind can spike. So the harsh reality is that euthanasia can increase suffering rather than end it. It's like going to sleep full of bad thoughts. Our chances of having a terrifying nightmare, an experience far worse than the thoughts that seeded it, are high. Because of the law of proximate karma, the momentum of the last thoughts before death re-arises in the post-death bardos. The second misconception is that the suffering that precedes death has no meaning. It seems rational for a dying person to ask, "Why should I endure this pain if the only way out is death? I'm going to die anyway. Why should I suffer so much?" But suffering can have great meaning and purpose. The suffering around death can be seen as the purification and exhaustion of past negative karma. That's exactly what death is, the final exhaustion of karma. This view can generate a new way to understand and transform our suffering, so that we bear it consciously. To attain enlightenment, we must purify karma in one of two ways, through meditation or through experience. We can view the suffering in life and death as the purification of karma through experience. Someone who endures suffering with equanimity is making the best of a difficult situation, purifying karma, and progressing along the spiritual path. We should let karma run its natural course. A precious opportunity, however painful, is lost with active euthanasia. The Dalai Lama says, "Your suffering is due to your own karma, and you have to bear the fruit of that karma anyway, in this life or another, unless you can find some way of purifying it. In that case, it is considered to be better to experience the karma in this life of a human, where you have more abilities to bear it in a better way, than, for example, an animal who is helpless and can suffer even more because of that." Instead of trying to end suffering by prematurely ending life, we should end our inappropriate relationship to suffering. Suffering comes when we contract around the pain and lose our perspective. This is why we introduced the pain meditation in part 1. Refer to the reverse meditations section in chapter 1. With a proper relationship, the pain remains, but it's softened and infused with new meaning. Instead of resisting the pain, which only exaggerates it, we can embrace the pain and ironically prevent the suffering. We can practice equanimity. Once again, putting hardship into perspective allows us to relate to it properly. Pack your bitter experience into a small mind, and it gets concentrated. It hurts. Make your mind as big as the sky, and that same experience is instantly diluted. Passive euthanasia is allowing someone to die a natural death. If someone is in a coma with no hope of recovery or kept alive by artificial means, then most teachers allow the removal of those means and the ensuing natural death. There comes a point when there's no need to prolong life and incur unnecessary emotional and financial burdens. With the advent of palliative medicine, which doesn't try to cure the illness but instead lessens its hardship, fewer people need to opt for euthanasia. Through palliative care and the proper view, we can transform a difficult death into a spiritual practice. Kalu Rinpoche says, "The person who decides that they have had enough suffering and wish to be allowed to die is in a situation that we cannot call virtuous or non-virtuous. We certainly cannot blame someone for making that decision. It is not a karmically negative act. It is simply the wish to avoid suffering, which is the fundamental wish of all living beings. On the other hand, it is not a particularly virtuous act either. Rather than being a wish to end one's life, it's a wish to end suffering. Therefore, it is a karmically neutral act. When a healer is instructed by a patient to remove life support systems, that puts the healer in a difficult position, because the instincts of the healer may be telling them, if this person stayed on the life support system, they would remain alive. If I take them off, they will die. The karmic consequences depend upon the healer's intent, because the healer will be depriving someone of the means to stay alive, regardless of the fact that it was that person that told us to do it. If the basic motivation of the healer has always been to help and benefit that person and relieve their suffering, then from that state of mind it seems as though nothing karmically negative can develop. Tonglen is one of the best meditations for a difficult death, both for the dying person and for caregivers. The rugged quality of Tonglen can meet and absorb any difficult death. Suicide. The suicide of a loved one is one of the most painful events imaginable. Even if we believe in reincarnation, the traditional Tibetan view concerning suicide doesn't comfort those left behind. It's mainly in Pure Land Buddhism, especially the Japanese schools, that the Tibetan stance is softened. This is probably due to the theistic view of exoteric Pure Land doctrine. In this view, it's okay to leave a hellish experience on earth if we're heading to a heavenly Pure Land. This is another example of how one's view of the afterlife influences the actions we take during life, including the conscious termination of it. Carl Becker, speaking in terms of the Japanese schools, writes, "There is nothing intrinsically wrong with taking one's own life, if not done in hate, anger, or fear. Equanimity or preparedness of mind is the main issue. The important consideration here is not whether the body lives or dies, but whether the mind can remain at peace and in harmony with itself." The early Buddhist texts include many cases of suicide that the Buddha himself accepted or condoned. Suicide is never condemned per se. It is the state of mind which determines the rightness or wrongness of the suicide situation. Matthew Ricard, speaking on behalf of the Tibetan approach, offers this different view. "By committing suicide, you destroy the possibility you have in this life of realizing the potential for transformation that you have within you. You succumb to an intense attack of discouragement, which, as we've seen, is a weakness, a form of laziness. By saying to yourself, 'What's the point in living?' you deprive yourself of the inner transformation that would have been possible. To overcome an obstacle is to transform it into an aid to your progress. People who've overcome a major trial in their lives often draw from it a teaching and a powerful inspiration on the spiritual path. Suicide solves nothing at all. It only shifts the problem to another state of consciousness." Scholar Damien Keown adds, "A person who opts for death, believing it to be a solution to suffering, has fundamentally misunderstood the first noble truth. The first noble truth teaches that death is the problem, not the solution. What is significant is that through the affirmation of death, he has, in his heart, embraced Mara." To reconcile disparate teachings and to address questions about the karmic implications of suicide, it helps to understand the four aspects of a fully established karma. What is karmic action made of? How are the consequences of an act established? Even though the topic of karma has entered the public domain, it is perhaps the most complex topic in Buddhism. Only a fully enlightened Buddha can understand karma. We will limit our discussion to how karma can help us relate to suicide. Understanding the aspects of a fully constituted karma also helps us relate to any action and to its karmic implications. What is it that packs the karmic punch? How can I soften the blow? In order for an action to have complete karmic repercussions, four components must be fully present. The first is the object or target of the action. If we take the extreme example of killing, the object would be the thing we're planning to kill. If the object is really clear, be it an insect, an animal, or a person, the first component is complete and the karmic impact is loaded. The second component is our motivation, which is the most important. If we want to kill something out of malice, then that aspect of karma is clear and complete. If we kill with the intent to feed our starving family or ourselves, or to save other sentient beings, then the karma is softened. Because motivation is so critical, it is helpful, revealing, and tempering to ask yourself before you do anything, what's my motivation? Why am I really doing this? This reality check can save you lots of trouble and future lives. The third constituent is the act itself. This is the clearest aspect. We either do it or we don't. Unlike the other three, this aspect is usually black or white, yes or no. We either step on the bug or not. The fourth constituent is having no regret or rejoicing in the act. If we look back upon what we did without remorse, if we're glad we stepped on the spider, we're in karmic trouble. But if we feel deep regret and vow not to repeat such an act, we have lightened the karmic debt. If each of these four constituents is complete, then the karma around the act is heavy. If we want to kill something out of anger, the thing we want to kill is clear, and we celebrate the act of killing, then karma is fully loaded. If we take these four aspects and apply them to suicide or euthanasia, we can better understand the reality of such acts. If we want to kill ourselves, the first constituent is often unclear. Are we really trying to kill ourselves or simply trying to kill the pain? Most suicide victims are terribly confused, and therefore the target of the act is not clear. The first constituent isn't complete, and the karmic implications aren't as heavy. The second aspect, our motivation, is also not clear. The motivation of most suicide victims is to remove suffering, which isn't a bad motivation. Sometimes people kill themselves to hurt others. In this case, the second constituent would be complete, and the karma correspondingly heavier. But a fuzzy intention softens the karmic impact. Many suicide victims, because of the intensity of their suffering, simply don't know what they're doing. It's almost as if they're drugged or stunned by the intensity of their pain. If you've ever been shocked with overwhelming bad news or immense trauma, you know the bewilderment that accompanies such a blow. You just can't think clearly. The third constituent, the act of suicide, is complete. We either kill ourselves or we don't. There's nothing fuzzy here. This is where the karmic repercussions mostly arise. The fourth constituent, having no regret or even rejoicing, is completely absent. There's nobody to rejoice in the act. Our action has cut off the last component. Of the four aspects of a fully constituted karma, only the third is clear and complete. Two of the other three are hazy and incomplete, and the fourth doesn't exist. Does this mean it's therefore okay to commit suicide? No. The Tibetan tradition is clear on this. Understanding these four components is to comfort those left behind, not to instill a justification for suicide. There's a reason why the tradition speaks of dreadful karmic consequences. We should heed these warnings. There are extraordinary stories of lamas in Tibet being led to execution by the Chinese and ejecting their consciousness by means of poa before the execution, an act that would normally be considered suicide. Some masters have said that these lamas were doing poa as a way to prevent their executioners from accruing the enormous negative karma of murder. In these exceptional cases, which only high lamas are even capable of performing, suicide is the best karmic act. For the rest of us, no matter how we try to rationalize it, suicide is a negative act. Unless you are a realized being whose every breath is taken to benefit others, you cannot kill yourself in a positive state of mind. Buddhism cannot put the fear of God into us because it's a non-theistic tradition. There is no creator principle, no God in Buddhism, and therefore no one to judge our actions. But Buddhism can put the fear of karma into us. This is wholesome fear, the recognition of the karmic implications of our actions. Suicide is a serious karmic act. But for those left behind, understanding the four aspects of a fully constituted karma can soften the pain and shed some light on a very dark event. Abortion and miscarriage. According to Buddhism, three things are necessary to bring about life: sperm, ovum, and bindu, consciousness. Biology, sperm and ovum, is not enough. Consciousness must enter between sperm and ovum for rebirth to occur. This means that life begins at conception, even if it's in a petri dish. The implications for miscarriage and abortion are immediate. The Dalai Lama, however, said that if science proves something that contradicts Buddhist doctrine, that doctrine needs to be re-examined and revised. This famous statement suggests that if science ever proves a later entry or emergence of consciousness in the womb, the Buddhist stance on abortion should change. In 1992, the Dalai Lama also said that there are instances where abortion may be warranted, for example, when a fetus is severely malformed and would have to endure great suffering in life. It is beyond our reach to explore why miscarriage takes place from a spiritual perspective. When asked, many teachers simply say karma. That may lead to helpful acceptance or to frustration. The point is that in miscarriage, stillbirth, or abortion, a death has taken place. The consciousness that entered the sperm and ovum now re-enters the bardos and begins the journey anew. All the practices associated with a normal death can be applied. At the least, a sukhavati can be performed. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche said, "The consciousness of those who die before birth, at birth, or in infancy will travel once again through the bardo states and take on another existence. The same meritorious practices and actions can be done for them as are usually performed for the dead. The purification practice and mantra recitation of Vajrasattva, offering of lights, purification of the ashes, and so on." Abortion is a more complex issue because of the karmic implications of that conscious choice. To understand the repercussions, study the four aspects of a fully constituted karma, as discussed previously. As we have seen, the principal karmic force is motivation. With the purest motivation, we can soften even the harshest action. When consulted by their students, many teachers will continue to support them even if they choose to go forward with the abortion. They may offer specific practices, like the purification practice of Vajrasattva, the recitation of sacred mantras, or the four opponent powers. Examine all the options, consult with wise advisors, know the implications, and act with the purest motivations. If one decides to abort, do so as soon as possible. Otherwise, the consciousness will continue to identify with the growing fetus, and the abortion becomes more difficult for that consciousness. Sogyal Rinpoche adds, "In the case of an abortion, in addition to the usual practices, if the parents feel remorse, they can help by acknowledging it, asking for forgiveness, and performing ardently the purification practice of Vajrasattva. They can also offer lights and save lives, or help others, or sponsor some humanitarian or spiritual project, dedicating it to the well-being and future enlightenment of the baby's consciousness." Zen teacher Robert Aiken has written a Buddhist ritual to both mourn the loss of the fetus and to solace the parents. There is also a famous Japanese ritual for abortion called Mizuko Kuyo that has been adapted by a Zen priest for Western women. Death of a pet. The death of a pet can be as painful as the loss of a human loved one. There is research suggesting that many people view their pet as a kind of surrogate child. As occupational and lifestyle choices have diversified, more people are opting not to have children. They find that a pet provides love and companionship much the way a child does. Pets become family. Many of the instructions we've discussed can be applied to the death of a pet. The Bardo literature is clear. These teachings work for all sentient beings, not just humans. Anyen Rinpoche says, "You can even place the mandala of the Takdrol on the heart of a pet who is dying. The power of dependent arising, when causes and conditions come together, is so truly amazing that even such a thing as liberation for a dog is possible. Every animal, be it a worm, insect, snake, or your pet cat, goes through the same bardos as we do. When the animal passes through the painful bardo of dying, the mind that was encased in the animal's body is liberated from that temporary housing. From that point on, which occurs when the mind enters the luminous bardo of Dharmata, it's no longer an animal's mind. It is now naked mind itself. Physical form of any kind is stripped off during the bardo of dying. What remains is formless awareness. It's like plunging through that inconceivably narrow funnel of the hourglass. In the two post-death bardos, it's no longer a snake's mind or an insect's mind or Fido's mind. The snake and the karma that hurled mind into that form have been shed. The insect and its karma have been exhausted. Fido and the habits that force that continuum of mind to take the form of a dog are left behind. The formless awareness that's revealed after death is the same awareness that you and I share when we reach that point in the bardos. As we have seen, if it's not recognized, this awareness will be blown by the winds of karma into a new form. This signals the end of the bardo of Dharmata and the beginning of the bardo of becoming. At this point, awareness starts to put on a new costume, assuming the habits from past lives that will result in a new body. But until it enters this karmic dressing room, every mind that passes through the bardo of Dharmata is completely naked and identical in its nature. We can look at this spiritual democracy from the opposite perspective. From our stance as a human, once our awareness drops this temporary human form in the bardo of dying, it could easily take on the appearance of a snake, an insect, or whatever shape expresses the karmic propensity at that moment. To become an animal in our next life, we only need to exercise an animal mind in this one. If we're pig-headed, stubborn as a mule, or full of dogged determination, we have acquired a karmic visa into the animal realm. You and your pet could easily switch roles. This view of the common roots of awareness that all sentient beings share a similar cosmic genealogy instills respect for every form of life. It allows us to honor the animal world and to treasure the sanctity of life as it dances across the spectrum of manifestation. While I was in India a few years ago, I heard His Holiness the 17th Karmapa give a teaching about compassionate heart, or bodhicitta, called the Sevenfold Cause and Result of Bodhicitta. The first of the causes, which build upon each other, is knowing that all sentient beings have been our mothers. This is a classic teaching in Buddhism, easily dismissed as Buddhist hyperbole or mere metaphor. But the Karmapa suggested this teaching be taken literally. His Holiness said that without the first cause, the second cause, let alone the other five, could not arise. This means that without viewing all sentient beings, including animals, as having once been our mother, we can't give rise to genuine compassion. The Karmapa then asked, "What is the measure that you have actually understood this first cause?" He answered his own question. When you can hear a dog bark and instantly say to yourself, "That's my mother," or when you hear a cow moo and immediately respond, "That's my mother." This is a humbling teaching. It shows us how far we have to go to attain this noble view of the animal kingdom. With this elevated view of animals, it's easy to transpose the bardo methods to our pets. Give them the best possible death, and therefore the best rebirth. We never know. Our treasured pet could someday be our mother again. Conclusion. In matters of such magnitude and with so many repercussions, it's important to do our homework. When it comes to karma, ignorance is never bliss. Once we know the rules, medically, legally, karmically, we can intelligently work within them. Even the Dalai Lama, who maintains the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism with unwavering strength, says that every student is responsible for checking the guru's instructions against reason. He says, "What happens when the guru gives us advice that we do not wish to follow or that contradicts dharma and reason? The yardstick must always be logical reasoning and dharma reason. Any advice that contradicts these is to be rejected." This was said by Buddha himself. "Accept my teachings only after examining them, as an analyst buys gold. Accept nothing out of mere faith in me." If one doubts the validity of what is being said, one should generally push the point and clear all doubts. This should be done with respect and humility, however, for to show any negativity toward a teacher is not a noble way of repaying his or her kindness. This shows us just how complex these issues truly are. Even the advice for listening to the advice is challenging. Gather as much information as you can. Check your motivation. Reflect deeply. And then trust your own heart and wisdom.